This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO.fm and clicking on donate today.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual 2013 Closer Electronic Music Festival, which starts June 20th. Closer PDX is hosting this cutting-edge electronic music and dance festival with an unparalleled selection of local and regional talent and labels. The Closer Electronic Music Festival is being held on the inner sides of East and West Portland at many different venues, from the kickoff at Crush on June 20th to the closer at Selwood Riverfront on June 23rd, there will be more than 50 performers and special guests. More information and tickets for this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Welcome to Between the Covers. I'm Ren Green, and today I'm speaking with Irish author Colm McCann about his eighth novel, Transatlantic. Colm won the 2009 National Book Award for his novel Let the Great World Spin. He's a distinguished professor of creative writing in the Master of Fine Arts program at Hunter College in New York, and he'll be at Powell's tonight at 7:30. Welcome, Colm.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
How do you describe your book, Transatlantic?
Ooh, that's a tough question, because sometimes people come along and they say, what's your book about? And my stock really bad first answer is, it's about 300 pages. But it is a series of transatlantic journeys. It's a sort of meditation on the relationship between Ireland and America, or North America, taking Frederick Douglass's trip across to Ireland in 1845, when he was just a young man, 27 years old, and still a slave. Also taking the very first transatlantic flight by Alcock and Brown in 1919 from Newfoundland to Galway, the ditch in a bog in Galway, and then also taking Senator George Mitchell's embarkation on possibly one of the most important moments in Irish history, which was the achievement of the peace process in 1998. So it expands, it covers three centuries, and so probably the best way to describe it is a tapestry of history, all woven together then also with the stories of women.
How was this book born? What was the original seed or scene or idea that you began with?
Pure desperation.
Personal desperation or the desperation of the people in the story?
Well, see, there you go. That's always the question. No, I'd finished a book called Let the Great World Spin, which for whatever reason, and I'm very grateful for it, had been very successful. And I was looking for a place to land, and part of me really, really wanted to go home, and home being Ireland, and I was really taken by the story of Douglas, and I tried very, very hard for a year to capture some sort of voice that might make sense of that time for him. Because when he went to Ireland, it was quite amazing that, you know, he stayed with the Anglo-Irish and the British and so on. But what he began to see unfolding at his feet was the Irish famine and the terrible, terrible poverty that the Irish people were presented with, while he was trying to represent his own 3 million people back here who were still in chains. So there were, you know, and so he's caught between the tension of, you know, looking after and speaking about his own people and then speaking out on behalf of the poor Irish.
Well, this seems like a good time for you to read this section I picked from the Frederick Douglass section.
For sure. And this is, you know, what I liked about Douglass, and what, I mean, Douglass is an extraordinary character in American history, was that he sort of embodied for me that Whitman-esque quote, you know, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I contain multitudes." So this is the piece where he looks at Irish politics. The politics still confounded him. Who was Irish? Who was British? Who was Catholic? Who was Protestant? Who owned the land? Whose child stood rheumy-eyed with hunger? Whose house was burned to the ground? Whose soil belonged to whom and why? The simple way to see it was that the British were Protestant, the Irish were Catholic. One ruled, the other lay underfoot. But where did Webb fit in, and where did Isabel fit in? He would gladly have allowed himself to align with the desires of freedom and justice, but it was to his own known cause that he had to remain entirely loyal. 3 million voices. He could not speak out against those who had brought him here as a visitor. There was only so much he could take upon himself. He had to look to what mattered. What was beyond toleration was the ownership of man and woman. The Irish were poor, but not enslaved. He had come here to hack away at the ropes that held American slavery in place. Sometimes it withered him, just to keep his mind steady. He was aware that the essence of proper intelligence was the embrace of contradiction, and the recognition of complexity was to be balanced against the need for simplicity. He was still a slave, fugitive. If he returned to Boston, he could be kidnapped at any time, taken south, strapped to a tree, whipped. His owners, they would make a spectacle of his fame. They had tried to silence him for many years already. No longer. He had been given a chance to speak out against what had held him in chains, and he would continue to do so until the links lay in pieces at his feet.
Oh, that was marvelous. To what extent is the Frederick Douglass in your book transatlantic character, and to what extent is he a historical figure? What kind of research did you do around him?
I mean, I suppose this is the elemental question about what the book is trying to do. It's a novel, but it's taking, you know, characters in history and it's interpreting them and trying to be true to what I would call the texture of the human impulse, rather than being true to the facts. You know, I am pretty precisely forensic about, you know, what when Douglas came over, you know, what ship he landed on, who he stayed with, and so I think that the section is more or less, you know, could be. I would stand up in a court of law and say that it's true, but much of it is, of course, invented, and that's the, you know, I had to research. And then I had to imagine what it was like, you know. For example, you know, Douglas in his later years, when we sort of know Douglas in his later years, when he's got that funky hair and all that, and he's that big gravitas about him. Well, in his later years, he used barbells. We know this for a fact because there were barbells in his house in Washington, D.C. But I give him barbells at the age of 27 when he travels to Ireland. Who knows whether he had barbells or not? Nobody will ever know. But it seemed to me to say an awful lot about him, his body, his mind, his relationship to where he wanted to be. And so that, you know, that's a fiction, but it seems to me to be to be true too.
In the book, Frederick Douglass is basically doing what you're doing now. He's on a press junket.
Yeah. And well, I wouldn't call it a junket. I mean, he was he was going because he had to. I mean, these people had threatened that they were going to kidnap him, and he wanted to speak out about abolition. And he was very, I mean, the reason he went was, you know, was extremely moral and directed. And you know, there was an anger about him, too. We can't forget that he was still a slave. So for him, there wasn't any idea that he was like sort of on a leg or he was on a junket. You know, he was going around because he was passionate about it and really wanted to see if he could whip up support for his ideas. It wasn't like, you know, he was selling anything to anyone. And there's something really powerfully true and decent about his impulse. But then he got he faced up against the poverty of Ireland, which was a very difficult thing to stomach.
Yes, he saw that there are people who are in horrible conditions, vastly different from slavery, but still abhorrent.
Yes, yeah. And that's tough because, you know, what do you speak out against? If you know these people are worse off than the people that you're trying to protect, but you know that the morality of slavery is something that goes deeper, as a deeper impulse than just, you know, ideas of freedom, which were sort of extant in Ireland at the time. You know, you have to be able to juggle these things. And I have great admiration for Douglas all the way down through history for what he did. And, he influenced Martin Luther King, obviously, and obviously influenced Obama, who's a big fan of Douglas and what he did.
So you just mentioned your book has three books. And book one, as you were just saying, discusses the first transatlantic flight, Frederick Douglass, Senator George Mitchell. In book two, you travel through time with several generations of women of Irish heritage, none of whom are historical figures. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, why are the men famous and the women fictional?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was like the small, supposedly anonymous corners of human history. What happens when, you know, because... You know, history is made up of more so of the small moments than the large narrative that we tend to give it. We give history to famous people supposedly and to men largely. It's men who created, men who have dictated it, men who say that they put these positions of power in place. But the true fact of the matter is that the women are the ones who embroider what I see as the real proper texture of history. For example, in Northern Ireland, which I write about in the book, it was the women who went out on the streets in the 1970s and said, enough of this bath of dying, enough of this killing. We need, and they started a women's coalition and so on. And they were the one who sort of suffered it blood and bone in so many ways. So it was important to me to write about women and their relationship to history and make a case for every life being sort of valuable.
I have a mechanics question. In books one and two, you use quotation dashes and third-person limited narration. Mm-hmm. And in book three, you switch to quotation marks and first-person. Can you tell me about those choices?
Well, okay. So book one has three major narrative strands that we talked about. Book two has three major narrative strands with three generations of women. They almost fold over onto each other and become the same thing. One is supposedly non-fiction with fictional characters entering it. The other is fiction with non-fiction characters entering into it. They collapse over onto one another. The third book is independent. And it's the first time I used the first person voice. And so I wanted to give it a different accent, if you will. And by just using quotation marks, it seemed to give it a different feel, a more intimate feel. And, you know, it's a trick, a device to wake the reader up as well. And they say, oh, what's this? This is new. This is different. This looks different, feels different.
You are listening to Between the Covers. I'm Ren Green. I'm here with Colin McCann, National Book Award winner, talking about his new novel, Transatlantic, and he's going to be at Powell's tonight at 7:30. Switching gears a little, your faculty bio at the European Graduate School says you went on an 18-month bike ride after you realized you didn't have the chops to write the great Irish-American novel. And that was years ago. Yeah. And how do you feel transatlantic stack up as a contender? Do you feel you are getting close to write? Do you feel you made it?
Oh, no, never made it. I mean, I said that thing.
This or is not the, yet. You yeah, haven't
well,
made it yet.
Yeah, well, yet. And yet being going to be a permanent yet. Because, you know, I said that thing about writing the great Irish American novel or the great American novel. I forget what I said. As a joke, you know. And then suddenly, you know, it gets, it got into a bio somehow, somewhere. And then it seems so pretentious. You know, I was 21 years old and I was going to sit down and write the great Irish American novel. Of course, I didn't feel that way. I mean, you know, these sort of things do follow you. But and the most important thing is that I don't think any novel that I've ever written has achieved what I wanted it to achieve. And part of that is just keeping your feet on the ground. And the other part of it is absolutely true and practical. If you write what you think is the perfect book or the perfect story, then you're in serious trouble. You know, where are you going to go from there? And I love the idea of failing. You never quite write the novel that would live up to your expectations, because then you just might as well stop. And I don't want to stop. I enjoy myself too much.
Do you feel that you're maturing into the storyteller you were hoping you would be? Not necessarily writing the penultimate book, but are you becoming the writer you hope to be someday?
I honestly never dreamed that I would be in this sort of position. I never had any idea that I could travel the country, travel the world, that my books would be read, that I would meet the people that I'm meeting and have access to, you know, working with charities, working with, you know, figures. I'm doing a film with J.J. Abrams. I'm doing all this stuff. It's all very cool and I have a good life. I live it out loud, but I also have a real responsibility to the idea of stories and storytelling, and that's where I'm most comfortable.
Your father was a journalist. He was a sports writer.
Yes.
And you studied journalism at university.
Yes.
And you became a journalist.
Yes.
How did you go from journalist to novelist?
I'm still a journalist. That's the thing. You see, I don't privilege the idea of a novelist over the idea of a poet, though I wish I could be a poet. And I certainly don't privilege the idea of a poet over that of a journalist or a playwright. I think it's all good. It's all good if it's good. The holy word put down on the page in the right place, doesn't matter where it happens to be, between the covers as you have the program, or between the newspaper pages or on stage. The right word. It's all about storytelling. I don't like this idea of fiction, non-fiction, all these different boxes that we seem to need to want to put people into. So I'm still a journalist and I'm also a fiction writer at the same time.
You recently talked with high school students in Newton, Connecticut.
Yeah.
After their English teacher wrote to you because they were personally involved with the Sandy Hook shooting and traumatized around that.
Right.
And this teacher used your novel, Let the Great World Spin, as a means to help teenagers cope and explore their feelings around this tragedy that had happened in their community. What was that like for you to go talk to those kids? And
that was devastating. And it was beautiful, and it was probably the best moment of my literary life, in the sense that I finally realized what I wanted to know about literature is that it can be used, and it's not just an airy fairy space for us to indulge our obsessions, but that it can actually be used in terms of being able to ignite debate, wake people's heads up, wake people's hearts up if it's properly done, and or injure people as well, or anger people. There's nothing wrong with art as that sort of social tool. But for me, going along, seeing those kids, and those kids were amazing. I didn't teach them anything. They read my book, sure, but they taught me stuff. I sat back and listened to them. They were talking about how their brothers and sisters had been killed, how they used to babysit for those children that had been murdered, and how they talked about darkness, and they talked about light, and how can they get any light from the darkness? Because it was really bad. We all know that what happened to them, and they're trying to recover. And the fact that they use literature to sort of aid the healing process is just amazing to me.
not just literature, but your literature.
Yeah, but I mean, it should be everyone's literature.
Yes, like, this is true.
Know, that's the thing. I was lucky. I'm the lucky one, you know, in that sense. But it does make me believe that there are so many books out there that could be used to do this, and so many poets and you know, playwrights, and indeed journalists who are there doing things. Somebody like Dan Barry, who's a New York Times journalist, I think he does incredible stuff, and he just writes, deeply engaged essays about what's going on in America, and they could read his stuff just as soon as they could read mine.
Well, I'm a little biased. I have an English degree, and it certainly speaks to the power of reading in school to helping kids develop character and becoming better people. Not just about reading the Scarlet Letter or whatever.
Right. We would hope so, right?
Empathy is a very high value for you as a human being, and you're involved with a charity called Narrative 4, which aims to spread empathy through story. Can you tell us about Narrative 4?
Yeah, we only launched it a couple of weeks ago. We have our first full conference coming up in Chicago. We got writers from all over the world. We got thinkers, we got musicians, Sting is involved, J.J. Abrams is involved, loads of people have come on board. And what we want to do is bring kids from all over the world together. Not that they can tell their story, which is fine. It's great to be able to tell your story, but to share their story with one another. Step into somebody else's shoes in what we call radical fearless hope through radical empathy. And, it's a charity, and anybody can go on to narrative4.com, where we have 100 stories by writers from all over the world, including Ian McEwan, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, David Robleski, Andy Sean Greer, Gabriel Byrne, the Irish actor, like all sorts of great people have contributed to this cause. And we are just hoping to do a little corner, and hopefully we'll work with kids from Portland at some stage. Can you imagine getting kids from Belfast across to Portland, and the kids from Portland tell their story, and then the Belfast kid would tell their story back to them? That's a great thing.
I lived in other countries as a kid, and it is very powerful to immerse yourself in other cultures and to find other perspectives. You grew up in Ireland. Mm-hmm. You live in New York now.
Right.
And I read that you and your wife lived in Japan for a while. Yeah. How are these connected for you?
Pasternak says that it takes a lot of volume to fill a life. And I think if anybody sat down to talk about their life, they'd find that there were all sorts of places and things involved. I mean, I came to America at the age of 21. I took a bicycle across the United States. I lived in Texas for a while, worked with juvenile delinquents, got married, went to Japan for a couple of years, went back to Ireland for a short while, and then moved to New York. And that sounds sort of breathlessly, vagabond, but it's not really. I mean, other people, you talk about the way they move, you probably move to a number of different countries, I just like the notion of movement. And also, what I like is the what Michael Ondaatje calls the international mongrels of the world. You know, all these people who come from one place and then, like, for example, him, born in Sri Lanka, educated in England, moves to Canada, but writes one of his very first books about a turn of the 20th century jazz musician in New Orleans. How cool is that?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. So I've got a list of some of your awards here. Hennessy New Irish Writer, Pushcart Prize, Rooney Prize, Irish Novel of the Year, 2002 Ireland Fund of Monaco Princess Grace Memorial Literary Award, National Book Award, and that's not even the complete list. Which of these was most shocking or surprising or flattering or out of the blue for you?
It has to be the National Book Award. I mean, I was the first Irish person or Irish born person to win the National Book Award. My brother Ronan, who lives in Portland here, he accompanied me to the National Book Awards. I think he let out a louder whoop than I did the night that we won it. I felt very much sort of that it was us winning it together. You know, my family, even somewhat for my country. I don't want to sound overly patriotic about the whole thing, but it was a big deal. It was a really big deal, and I'll never forget it. Although, like, late the next morning, I sort of overserved, if you will, in one of the local pubs, and my friend Danny McDonald was waving at me desperately across the bar, and I was singing Raglan Road or some other song, and he says, there's a phone call for you. I said, have him wait, I'm going to finish the song. It turned out to be the Irish president on the line.
Oh, like, my gosh. Did you finish the song, or did you talk to
I finished the song. That's terrible. It's dreadful, isn't it?
That's
dreadful.
Marvelous. Well, you know, there's a guy who gets what he wants most of the time. He had to wait.
Yes.
So, I was struck by your prose, which is very elegant. You're economical, but you're lyrical. Your sentences are short and not necessarily complete in the grammatical sense.
Right.
And your style lends itself well to the kinds of intimate stories that you tell. But if you wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it would be a completely different story.
Right.
So what do you feel some of the limitations of your style might be? And have you ever read any books or genres and thought, damn, I wish I could make that.
Sure. But language is like landscape. I mean, and the language should suit the landscape of your story. So some parts are lush and green and rolling hills and rivers and things like that. Others are like cities, and they're staccato, and they stop the rhythm and boom, boom, boom. And they sort of draw attention to themselves in their staccato rhythms. I mean, there's writing that I read all the time that I admire, not necessarily jealous of, because I'd be able to do it myself. But when you read somebody like Don DeLillo, it's just fantastic. Reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez, all that stuff, it really sort of floats my boat. And who knows? I might write a novel with no full stops now next time around. We'll see. Just because messing with style is fun too.
What are you reading these days?
I'm reading one of my students. I teach at Hunter College in New York, and one of my students is Bill Cheng, who wrote Southern Cross the Dog. Fantastic book. He's a first generation Chinese immigrant. He writes a novel about the blues in Mississippi. Get that. It's fantastic. It's really fantastic. Another student, Jessica Sofer, wrote Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, a story about an Iraqi Jewish woman who lives in New York and a 14-year-old pain addict who becomes her friend. Two great novels, and both by students of mine.
So you mentioned earlier that J.J. Abrams is participating in Narrative 4, and he optioned the film rights to Let the Great World Spin, and you've been working on the screenplay.
Yeah.
Your characters, in Transatlantic at least, are very internal and introspective, and I thought of them all as very quiet people, whereas screenwriting, dialogue moves the action. How's your transition from screenwriting to novel writing, or novel to screen, rather?
It's interesting. I mean, not a lot of writers get a chance to do their own novel for the screen. But JJ gave me a chance because he sort of believes in the story and believes that we could do it. And I said to him, listen, you know, a good book gets written. If you're lucky, it's a good book. That's great. Wonderful. But you shouldn't be slavishly adapting it perfectly. So I thought it best to just let it, I basically took the book, dropped it on the ground, smashed to the ground. I started picking up different pieces of it. And the film will be very different to what the book is. But I think that's necessary.
Okay. Do you have any guilty pleasures in terms of literature? You know, the things you might...
Oh, I thought you were talking about guilty pleasures in terms of life. And I was like, oh, what am I going to say
now? We don't have to go into your felonies.
Guilty pleasures. I mean, I'm a bit of a snob, I have to say. I don't read I'm not into genre fiction and stuff like that. And I don't like myself necessarily for that. I don't read science fiction. I don't read any of the trashy sort of, even the word trashy is wrong, the big blockbusters, the things like that. I just like good literature. I like the sound of words and give me a well-written book any day of the week. I'm just happy to embark on that.
Oh, right on. Right on. Anything else you'd like to say while you've got our microphone in front of your mouth?
I'm so happy to be, I look forward to meeting people in Powell's and tonight. And if people can support Narrative 4, narrative4.com, that's the place to go. Deeply appreciate it. And thanks for all your time.
Well, how can people support Narrative 4? What are you?
Well, we have the website is open, and you can contribute to the website, and you can buy for $5 only access to 106 different writers, original pieces of fiction, and you can give $5, $10, $20, $100, $100,000 if you want. Which is, you know, that would be fantastic. That'll help all these kids around the world get together and share their stories. And also, eventually, we're going to be looking for people, volunteers and schools and things like that to help us out. So, there are lots of ways to help.
And how can kids participate? How are you choosing the children who are going to participate in your Narrative 4 program?
Well, we're finding people who are we're finding people who are on the ground with organizations, social workers, youth workers, people who are at the coal face of, you know, what's going on in the world, and they know the sort of kids who need to tell their stories, and they come to us and they help develop the program on the ground. And then we have writers in each of the individual towns who help nurture the program too. It's a big collaboration. It's a collaboration of empathy.
Excellent. Once again, you've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Ren Green, and I've been speaking with Colin McCann, the National Book Award winner, about his new novel, Transatlantic, and he will be at Powell's tonight at 7:30. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I want to invite you to come out to see Long Distance Revolutionary, a documentary about Mumia Abu-Jamal. This film chronicles his life as a revolutionary, a writer, a journalist, a philosopher, and an inspiration to people worldwide. It's showing June 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. That's a Friday night
at 7 p.m.
That starts the week-long run of Long Distance Revolutionary in Portland. KBOO is proud to bring you this event, and I hope to see you there.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at KBOO.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Radio Zine. I'm your host today, Leanne Kranz. With me in the studio this morning is local poet Paul Ann Peterson.